with me. I want my arm about you. That charm about you will carry me through to heaven. I'm in heaven, and my heart beats so that I can hardly speak. And I seem to find that happiness I seek when we're out together dancing, out together dancing, out together dancing cheek to cheek.
Dancing cheek to cheek, or just on our own, which is what Henry Alford did. Henry is my interviewee on tonight's Sharon Hour, just starting. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's one and only KX935. Henry is an author and journalist of note. His latest book is titled And Then We Danced, A Voyage into the Groove, and that's what we're going to be focused on tonight. But he's written many other books with intriguing titles, such as Would It Kill You to Stop Doing That? A Modern Guide to Manners, How to Live, A Search for Wisdom from Old People While They're Still on This Earth, Out There, One Man's Search for the Funniest Person on the Internet, Municipal Bondage, and Big Kiss, One Actor's Desperate Attempt to Claw His Way to the Top. In addition to his books, Henry has written for such prestigious publications as The New York Times, The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, and in order to present us with his latest exploration, Henry has spent the last 7 years dancing his way through life, exploring every kind of dance he could think of. His 7-year hitch into the world of dance began with an article he'd written on Zumba class he'd taken, and then he expanded it into this wonderful book, And Then We Danced, subtitled A Voyage into the Groove. I'm going to read you a few of the rave reviews his book got. Here's from the New York Times. Alford seamlessly interviews heartwarming and hilarious anecdotes about his deep dive into all things dance. Captivating. Vanity Fair says, reading Henry Alford, the most graceful of humorists, is like being in the hands of a commanding dance partner. A spin here, a dip there, the perfect landing on le mot juste, as the music or sentence stops. So perhaps his new book, And Then We Danced, A Voyage into the Groove, was as inevitable as it is sublime. But more, it is joyful, a dance all its own. So let's meet the man that inspired those raves and hear what these last 7 years, literally dancing through life, have taught him. Henry lives in New York, so I'm afraid this interview had to be over the telephone, which is why it sounds a little muffled. I'm going to quote from your book. You say, we're drawn to specific activities or people because they have a lesson to teach us, but it's never the lesson we thought it was going to be. And that struck me as so true. So what was the seminal lesson you learned by learning to dance all these different dances? And did it involve learning to dance all the dances, or would it have been the lesson you'd have learned, period, even if you'd just chosen, you know, one form of dance, ballet or ecstatic, versus you did everything, right? Tap and ballroom.
I think I did like 12 or 13 different forms. You know, for me, I think the big lesson was this idea that anyone can dance, that when you get interested in dance, you know, most people are drawn in by the virtuoso elements of dance. You know, anything that Fred Astaire does, or like a young Baryshnikov taking the stage, or some people adore the tricks. You know, if you watch any of the dance shows on TV, they really are all about dancers doing just insane tricks that many dancers couldn't even do 30 or 40 years ago. So I think it's really easy to get caught up in that stuff, whether you're a dance enthusiast or whether you're actually dancing yourself. But at the end of the day, the most beautiful dancing that I've seen in the past 7 years is very often done by people who are beginners or people over the age of 70 or people who are purely social dancers, not professional dancers. Yes, it's incredible to be trained and to have all this technique, but by the same token, I think what is really moving in performance or moving when you watch it is very often stuff that has some kind of emotion behind it rather than some spectacular technique behind it.
Who was it that said, was it Martha Graham or Twyla Tharp that said something about the passion is more important than the technique?
I don't know that quote, but yes, I would believe it of either of them. Martha Graham said, movement never lies, which is sort of verging on what I'm talking about in this idea that at its heart, what I love to watch and what I think most people love to watch is some kind of an emotional or a spiritual or there's some kind of offering that a dancer makes, and it doesn't really have anything to do with how high they can leap or how quickly they can somersault backwards.
Good to hear, huh, for us aspiring dancers. You're tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. And my guest tonight is writer Henry Alford. He's written a book, a wonderful book, And Then We Danced. That's the name of the book. And I'm interviewing him by telephone from New York. The first thing I wanted to know was what led him to write this book, and not just to write it, but to spend the past 7 years learning every possible dance he could in order to do so.
It really started about 7 years ago. I just started dancing in my living room after dinner. I was so stressed out. I was writing a lot for the New York Times, and I just needed to bodily thrash to get rid of the day. So I just went into my living room, put on some Beyonce, and just started grooving. It just sort of came over me, and it really helped. And then I told a friend about this somewhat strange ritual, and she said to me, well, you know, there are other people who have your problem. There are other people who are getting together outside of the home and dancing. So why don't you look into ecstatic dancing, which is essentially what I was doing in its sort of current application. It's just people putting on music and then really shaking and thrashing about.
I did that once at this non-denominational church we have here in Laguna Beach, and everybody just does their own thing on the dance
floor. What did you think?
I was a little self-conscious, to tell you the truth. I mean, I did do my thing in my little corner, and it was fine, but I have to admit I was a little self-conscious. Were you not?
Oh, absolutely. No, it was very much about me hiding in the shadow, often with my eyes closed, but yet definitely not engaging in any eye contact whatsoever. And yeah, that's really been sort of my journey, for lack of a better word, these past 7 years, is that I'm trying to look people in the eyes when I dance with them now. And it ain't easy. It's really, really tough to let your freak flag fly while looking at someone. I don't know why that is, but so currently I dance for like 2 hours a week on Saturdays, and I would say I have intermittent eye contact. I can't quite sustain it.
But you're okay with bodily contact from your book. You don't withdraw from that at all, because that's another thing that would be hard for me as a reserved sort of person, to completely have bodily contact with a stranger. But I think I'm a bit weird like that, because I don't even like massage. Everyone thinks I'm very peculiar. And I love it from somebody that I am intimate with, but just to go to somebody I don't know and have them pummel me, or have somebody suddenly kind of attack me from behind, is a little hard.
It's really weird at first, and then once you accept the implied contract, you know, once both parties do, then it seems totally normal to you. The weirdness for me went away, I would say, in about month two of doing this one kind of dancing that I do called contact improvisation, which is a lot of leaning on people and balancing your weight on them. But I totally hear you. That's not what most people want to do, and I think most people would be, yes, hugely uncomfortable.
But the funny thing is, you're a journalist, so you interview people. Do you have any problem looking in the eye when you're asking them profound questions, or do you not ask profound questions?
I'm trying to think. No, I can look people in the eye. I do find that when I interview people, if I have to ask a big question, you know, a question that I know is going to make them uneasy, then I'm much more comfortable if I have preceded it with some kind of confession of my own. That, you know, unless I put a little blood on the table, I'm not going to ask the other person to do so.
Yeah, totally. I'm with you on that, too. Then it makes it more of a sort of an equal conversation than an I'm in charge sort
exactly.
of thing.
Exactly. Otherwise, it's totally weird. I mean, one time I had to interview the actress Charlize Theron, who, when she was a young girl, witnessed her mother shoot and, I believe, kill her father.
Yes, I think so.
And the magazine editors told me, I think she's only talked about it once or twice on the record, but we would love to hear about that. And so I sat down and thought good and hard about, well, what can I say to her about my life? What can I reveal about myself before I ask that question? Because otherwise, I am not going to ask that question.
So what did you?
Do I have to tell you?
Yes. No, that's okay. We won't go there. But talking about interviews, you interviewed some of the greats, right? You interviewed Twyla.
I did. I interviewed Twyla Tharp, and I interviewed Arthur Murray's daughter. It's more a book of doing than interviewing, because that's the kind of writer I am, that I like to go and do stuff and then come back and tell you all about it. Whereas sitting down and asking a bunch of questions that a famous person has been asked a million times, it seems a little too rote to me sometimes.
No, I understand. But it was fun to actually learn things. I mean, the thing about Arthur Murray renouncing his Jewishness and making his daughters have nose jobs. What struck me as amusing was that he was Moses Teichman, right? He renamed himself Arthur Murray. If he'd named himself Murray Arthur, he'd have been blowing his own cover. It's such an odd thing that he picked, really. Such another Jewish name.
Yeah, it is really weird. But to my mind, he was such a perfect example of dance as aspiration, that he grew up poor on the Lower East Side. He stuttered. He was gawky, insecure. And through taking dance and, you know, learning how to dance, he overcame all that stuff. And then, moreover, at the height of his popularity in the 50s, when he had 300 dance studios, his dance studios employed all these aristocrats. And that was hilarious to me, that he was so self-made that suddenly he was hiring countesses and principesses.
That was very interesting. I didn't know anything about that. And I didn't know that he started, and it makes sense because he was so shy and he figured people would not want to dance in public. So he started as a mail order dance.
Yeah, exactly. He would sell paper footsteps that you would put down on the floor, and they were numbered, and they corresponded to instructions in a booklet. So anyone who's self-conscious or embarrassed about dancing could learn on his own at home.
Yes, quietly, and then go out and surprise the world.
Exactly.
What all those old musicals were, you know, suddenly, oh my God, he can dance.
Put on your dancing shoes, stop wasting time. Put on your dancing shoes, watch your spirits climb. Shall we dance or keep on moping? Shall we dance and walk on air? Shall we give in to despair or shall we dance with never a care? Life is short, we're growing older, don't you be an also-ran. You better dance, little lady, dance, little man. Dance whenever you can.
God, how I dream to dance like Fred Astaire, or Ginger Rogers, or even more Sid Charisse, but even more Fred Astaire, I have to confess. I'm Sharon James. This is the Sharon Hour on Laguna's KX935, and I have as my guest tonight the acclaimed author and journalist. He writes for the New Yorker, Vanity Fair, New York Times, Henry Alford. Henry has spent the last 7 years dancing every dance he could think of for his book called And Then We Danced. And when we were talking about tap dancing, I felt compelled to relate my attempts in that area.
My husband was in a Broadway show that Tommy Tune did, A Day in Hollywood, Night in the Ukraine, and he had to learn how to do tap, which he didn't know how to do tap. He was trained as an actor. He wasn't trained in musical theatre, really. So I went with him. I thought, how great, this will be a good chance for me to learn tap and be Fred Astaire. I found it extraordinarily difficult, and he, being very athletic, picked it up immediately. So I don't know whether you have to have rhythm first or athleticism first or both.
I think it depends on the particular dance idiom. I'm surprised by your story about tap because I think of tap as being one of the less athletic forms of dance. It's really interesting when you take a tap class, they almost don't mention your upper torso at all. It's all about what's happening below the knees, and it's very much like taking a drumming class for your feet.
I like that analogy, and funnily enough, my friend's son and daughter have a band called, I love the title, it's called He's My Brother, She's My Sister. Her son's girlfriend, now wife, actually plays percussion by tapping on top of the drums.
Oh, I love it.
It's fabulous.
Love it.
It's great fun. And it makes absolute sense. That's, even drumming is athletic. It takes a lot of athleticism, I would think, to drum.
It takes stamina, but because it's not full body, particularly that first year when you're learning the rhythms and stuff, or it's less full body than other kinds of dance. If you compare it to something like ballet or swing dancing, where you're really thinking about what am I doing with my arms? Are my shoulders relaxed? Is my upper torso? In addition to what am I doing with my feet? Sometimes when, you know, people over 60 ask me, well, I have limited mobility, I would love to do something weekly, take a class, what of all those kinds of dance that you studied for the book, which would be the best? Tap is one that I do mention, because I do think, you know, if you take an hour-long tap class, you might sweat a little bit, whereas if you take an hour of ballet or Zumba or contact improvisation or swing dancing, you might be be drenched in sweat. I would be drenched in sweat.
I don't like being drenched in sweat. But I am very drawn to taking bar lessons because I like the fact that that would keep you limber. And I love the story of Luigi in your book. That was one of my favorite stories. I love, what was it that he said when he had this car accident and they told him that he'd never walk again? He said, I don't want to walk again. I want to dance.
Exactly.
I love that.
Yeah, a Broadway performer goes out to Hollywood, gets in this horrific car accident, was in a coma for a couple of months, and then through a series of mostly doing bar work, holding on to a wooden bar and doing tendus or small leg lifts, and completely rehabilitated himself and ends up working in a bunch of Hollywood musicals and befriending Gene Kelly, who becomes his mentor. So the Luigi technique, which he developed, still thrives, and it's a very kind of elegant, smooth series of exercises. And yeah, I think that's a really lovely one for someone who just wants to dip their toe into a dance form.
Literally.
Because it is at an adagio pace, so you're not going to be out of breath.
Liza Minnelli, when she went through all that physical deterioration, you said that she took this Luigi technique.
She did, because her father, of course, being Vincent Minnelli, doing all those musicals, somehow she meets Luigi on one of her father's sets, and he becomes her godfather. And so when she moved to New York as an adult, she was taking classes with him. And yeah, she has had all sorts of back problems. Then there's even a weird episode where she got encephalitis from a mosquito bite. And by doing this Luigi technique, she was able to keep her career. And then when she was cast on Arrested Development, the TV show, there was a point where her character Lucille had to fall down stairs. And they told Liza Minnelli, okay, we're going to bring in your stunt double for the fall. And Liza said, no, I will talk to Luigi. I want to do it myself.
Yeah.
So she could even do that.
Fantastic.
And she never stopped performing through the pain, emotional as well as physical, following her beloved mother, Judy Garland's, death.
Excuse me, sir. Yes, you right there. When I was 5, I sat in your chair. Hear the pass right there in your seat. I did. I came to see a lady who, in fact, I was related to, who packed my lunches, wiped my nose, and cooked me cream of wheat. Everyone around me was excited. Everywhere I looked, there was this buzz. I was not too sure of what I'd see here, but I could tell that everyone felt lucky just to be here. Then the house lights dimmed, and the spotlight shone as she stepped up to the microphone. That was the first time I could feel and see that tingling electricity. I'll never forget what she and her music did to me. What it when she sang, she sang. I played the states, the capital, but people said, don't stop until you play the palace. You haven't played the top. For years, I had it preached to me and drummed into my head. Unless you play the palace, you might as well be dead. A team of hoofers was the headline at the Majestic down in Dallas. But they canceled the day, their agent called to say, you can open the bill at the palace. So it became the Hall of Fame, the Mecca of the trade. When you had played the palace, you knew that you were made. So I hope you'll understand my wondrous thrill, 'cause Vaudeville's back at the palace and I'm on the bill.
And on the bill she was, singing and dancing her way through cabaret and Chicago and a variety of Candor and Ebb musicals on Broadway, matching her mother Judy Garland's magnetism and fame. You're tuned to The Sharon Now with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. My guest tonight is writer Henry Alford, who's written a wonderful book, And Then We Danced, A Voyage into the Groove. One thing he mentioned in his book that somewhat took me aback was that Fred Astaire had pegged himself as an angry dancer.
You mentioned he thought of himself as a violent dancer.
Wasn't that wild? But if you go back and look at some of the movies, you will see that there is this kind of outlaw style, that for as many dances that are all about that swoony, elegant, floating quality, there are also dances where he's knocking stuff out of people's hands or where he's kicking things. But the genesis of that little section was in 1983, right after Michael Jackson debuted the moonwalk. So the first time he ever performed the moonwalk in public was on a Motown television special. And the next morning, Fred Astaire calls Michael Jackson up and says, hey, you're an angry dancer, just like me.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, I can see that he was sort of a rebel, but not a gangster, you know? He was very debonair, like the dancing equivalent of, say, Rupert Everett. As opposed to Gene Kelly. Gene Kelly was really handsome and a matinee idol. He was a man, and Fred Astaire was just like a kinetic thing. I didn't even think past Fred Astaire's dancing, although he was a beautiful singer as well.
Yeah, just... one film critic put it that Gene Kelly bleeds and Fred Astaire doesn't. But Gene Kelly was a living, palpable flesh and blood. He was like the best-looking guy in your neighborhood. Whereas Fred Astaire, yeah, there is this kind of otherworldly thing about him. And I think that's why people have such a hard time seeing this idea of the angry dancer. For some reason, we don't see this kind of more visceral aspect.
I guess we don't generally equate dance with anything angry, do we? I mean, the other thing in your book about the High Times crew who were arrested in the subway.
Yeah, in the early 80s, the cops stopped them because they think that they're a gang who's getting into trouble. And it turns out, no, they were just doing hip-hop. And so the High Times crew said to the cops, well, let us show you some of our moves. And the moves had names like The Baby, or, you know, Crawl, or these really not very violent names. And, yeah, the cops let them off the hook.
That's great. I mean, do you ever feel that you're expressing anger in your dance when you do your ecstatic dancing?
I do, a little bit, but I feel like it's that dance can be a way to grapple with tension, anxiety, sort of hormonal imbalances. I think that if you go dance for a couple of hours, that's going to lead to a really great night's sleep. I think it's going to lower your blood pressure. It's going to do all of these physical things, which, you know, at the time you're not thinking, oh, I'm thrashing my limbs, I must be angry. It's more about this kind of energy inside you that you're dealing with.
Yeah, you reminded me, the Shakers, one always thinks of as this staid religious cult. You forget they were the Shaking Quakers, right? They were Quakers who let it all out through ecstatic dance.
Exactly, that was the whole point, was that, yeah, through some kind of bodily action, you were making yourself a vessel for religious transformation. You were trying to get rid of the anxiety of the everyday. And so, yeah, that's totally part and parcel of my dancing in the living room to Beyonce. Hey, hey, I wanna be myself and let the rage in my body. I wanna be myself and let the rage in my body. I wanna let it out and let the rage in my body. I wanna party, I wanna dance, I wanna be myself and let the rage in my body. Hey, mystify, tell me how, let's go. Time to move your little hips, find my nose, find my nose. Hey.
Had I not noticed that before, that dance numbers certainly can have anger in them, or a way to release that anger. Dance is the topic of my share an hour tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. And my guest is the author and celebrated journalist Henry Alford, who has written a book called And Then We Danced, A Voyage into the Groove, the result of a 7-year exploration into pretty much every form of dance we know about.
Next week we have a drum circle on the beach, and it's amazing how with drum circle you just really, you kind of move into a different era. You become a caveman. Can't help it. It's so compelling. I don't know whether that's the actual beat that does something to your innards, that reorchestrates things inside you. What do you think?
I think you're right. I think it is the beat that somehow activates some kind of primordial consciousness in you. You know, the anthropologists say that the first dances were early man kind of thrashing about to ward off predators. Sort of like if you see a bear out in the woods, you're supposed to make a lot of noise and make yourself large. So if those are man's first dances, then we become sort of hardwired to think of those sorts of movements as a way to protect ourselves. Think of a football team doing their huddle at the beginning of the game or doing their victory dances at the end. Yeah, there is that somehow we have this primal relationship between making big, crazy movements and protecting ourselves or forming a group, warding off scary things. So, yeah, I think there's a direct connection.
Speaking of that, I was thinking about the historical, chronological, cultural context of dance. And I realized that it started off really with a sort of tribal just flinging ourselves around. As you said, maybe it was a protective thing to ward off spirits or animals. And then men and women started flinging each other around. Well, I mean, not exactly in quite that historical context, but the jive was like us flinging each other around. The minuet in the 17th century was also pushing each other around, wasn't it? And then we went to those formation dances that were separate but communal and very much prescribed. We literally went around each other in circles or squares. And then we would just go to something like the twist or a John Travolta type of thing where we just fling ourselves around. So I don't know whether it reflects anything particular. It's a hard thing to throw at you, but if you have any thoughts on whether it reflects anything particular that's going on in our development, in our culture, whether we dance separately or together, whether we push each other around, or whether the man leads, or whether we're independent.
No, it's fascinating to look at the evolution of all those different kinds of dance that you mentioned. You know, I think a lot of those examples that you gave are that dance is being used as a way to learn how to interact with other people, particularly with members of the opposite sex, in the same way that dance is used sometimes in schools where you teach a bunch of 7- and 8-year-olds how to do a square dance. Not because it's going to help them lose weight, not because it's going to help them improve their rhythm, not because it's going to expose them to some cultural artifact, but really because kids that age need to learn what you can and can't, you know, where you can touch someone, where you can't. If your hand is sweaty, can you put it on another person's shoulder? You know, all of those really tricky little questions. That seems like a one through line.
Remember those formation dances, listener? Hasn't been one in a while. And of course, with those formation dances, you didn't touch anybody, but it was still communal. You're tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935, talking to Henry Alford, who's written a book all about dance called And Then We Danced, with anecdotal information on jazz, tap, ballet, classical, intimate dancing, dancing on one's own, ecstatic dancing, and these formation dances. When it comes to those, there was none of the anxiety of where do I touch, how do I touch. They were communal without being interpersonal. You didn't have to touch each other. You just mimicked each other, and there was such a feeling of unity through that. I remember coming back from France as a teenager where Le Madison Twist was all the rage. Johnny Hallyday, who was France's Elvis Presley, sang Le Madison, and so did his girlfriend, then wife, Sylvie Vartan. Anyway, I was privy to it firsthand, so I could come back to my little gang at the pub and teach them all how to do it.
Le Madison Twist. Les mains avec le pied droit. Pointé deux fois sur le côté. Un, deux, trois, quatre. Pareil avec le gauche. Cinq, six, sept, huit. Ensuite, on met le talon devant sur un, deux temps. Pointe derrière. Trois, quatre. Ensuite, talon, pointe, talon, pointe. On recommence depuis le début? Allez, on y va, je compte. Un, deux, trois, quatre. Cinq, six, sept, huit. 1, 2, 3.
To the left, to the right. Come on everybody, dance the Madison.
Venez danser le Madison. ça sonne. C'est fou la joie que ça vous donne. Ça tourne et la rythmique est bonne. Le Mary, Mary, Madison. Madison. C'est chaud le Madison. Venez danser le Madison. Tout sur la piste quand ça sonne. C'est fou la joie que ça vous donne. Ça tourne et la rythmique est bonne. Le Mary, Mary, Madison. Madison. C'est chaud le Madison.
So if Le Madison Twist was the fun line dance of my teenage years, for writer Henry Alford, who's my guest on tonight's KX935's The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, it was the bus stop.
Should we try?
5, 6, 7, 8.
Are you up on your feet, everyone? These disco or formation dances were embraced by us in our teenage years because, as Henry Alford writes in his book on dance, And Then We Danced, it was, quote, the fact that we stood shoulder to shoulder while dancing meant that we didn't have to look at one another, which hugely reduced the potential embarrassment. Plus, months later, when we ran into one another in the hallway at school, we'd each do the heel tap in the manner of a secret handshake. What Henry is proposing here is that the joy in these formation dances was that lovely feeling of sharing something, but being able to do it in the most prescribed, independent kind of way. And of course, that kind of sharing is what I try to do with this, the Share an Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's one and only FM public listener-supported radio station, KX935. That said, communal activities don't necessarily preclude us from being judged by others.
You mentioned the minuet. That's an interesting one because the minuet was very clearly a way for people in the 17th century to make moral judgments about the other dancers. Those dancers were looking at each other, and you had poor form doing the minuet, then all sorts of assumptions were made about your moral failings. You know, Lord S. doesn't move his feet when he dances. I imagine he's a rather stubborn and unsuccessful gentleman, that kind of thing.
Really? So yeah. I wonder, do we do the same, though, don't we, when we watch people dance? We do it.
Do a little bit, yeah. We have these kind of preconceived, I mean, they may or may not be accurate, but yes, we look at someone dancing and we come away with ideas about how extroverted that person is, what that person would be like in bed, you know, is that person happy or sad? Yeah, I think there are a lot of assumptions people make.
But I think it's probably more to the degree of abandon. We don't really judge them so much on technique, right? Or do we?
I don't think we do, particularly non-professionals. But yes, I've stood with people at a dance, stood on the sidelines, and while watching a dancer on the floor really thrashing and really throwing himself into it, the other bystander whispered to me something about, oh, I wonder if that person has a drug or alcohol problem.
Well, I think we would make that judgment if somebody were literally going crazy on the dance floor, I think.
A quick reminder here that you're tuned to the Share an Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. Tonight, I'm interviewing writer Henry Alford about his book on dance called And Then We Danced. And I mentioned to him that Laguna Dance had recently hosted Patrick Corbin here at the Laguna Theatre, who was a principal dancer for the Paul Taylor Company. Paul Taylor was himself a protege of Martha Graham, and Twyla Tharp was a protege of Paul Taylor. Henry actually danced Twyla Tharp's famous 100s.
Was that fun?
Oh, I loved it. It's a very cool thing that she does. She'll come into a town where her troupe is performing, and she will do this as sort of like a community outreach thing, and I got to do it in downtown Manhattan. It was really a blast. You and 99 other strangers are creating this really beautiful thing. To me, it was somewhere between going backstage at a Broadway show and hearing your name over the radio. You know, there's just this wonderful self-involved sense of fun that, oh my God, I get to work with Twyla Tharp and her dancers. So Twyla Tharp was in Paul Taylor's company. They didn't really get along. She was very satirical about him. And in his memoir, he refers to her as an adorable little mole twerp.
Do you think that was a put down?
I know. It's a slap and a kiss.
I know. So funny.
Paul Taylor danced for Martha Graham. And, you know, Martha Graham's a fascinating figure because she really was so adamant about the role of sex in dance. There's a fun anecdote where she once went to a college in Texas and she announced in her very high priestess manner, all dance comes from the lonely place. And a young student in the back of the room said, Miss Graham, what do you mean by where is the lonely place? And Martha Graham says, between your legs. Next question. So she had a lot of kind of really weird, they're not weird, but it almost feels like a Freudian overlay onto the physical activity of dance. And again, in Paul Taylor's memoir, he alludes to that.
And I love your comment that she wanted to dance like a Kandinsky painting. That was very resonant.
Yeah, it's wild. But if you see Martha Graham's works, they're angular and really full of energy and all sorts of weird, like, backwards skittering with locked knees. She loved people to fall backwards. It's very sharp and angular and pointed, which is not what many people are doing today. Her most famous one, it's a solo piece. The dancer doesn't even stand. It's a woman who's seated, and she's encased in like a tube of jersey fabric, and it's just her kind of undulating in this piece of jersey, so you see all the shadows that her knees and elbows create, and it just seems so modern, and you wonder, well, if it were 1959 and this is what someone was doing on stage, of course it would seem really radical and strange.
Sort of ecstatic dancing, isn't it?
In a way. She, of course, brought all sorts of mythology and psychology and stuff to her choreography, so it was very freighted, but emotion played a huge part in her dances.
You're listening to Henry Alford, my guest on tonight's KX935's The Sharer Now, with me, Sharon James, talking about dance in reference to his latest book, And Then We Danced, A Voyage into the Groove. Henry is an author and journalist, and he interviewed some of these classic modern dancers like Twyla Tharp, but the book is mainly a memoir about the 7 years he took to learn every possible kind of dance he could think of. I told him about my own foray into dance as an adult when my husband had to learn how to tap dance for a Broadway show he was doing, and I went along with him.
But I was so disappointed with myself. I think I was probably put off by my husband sailing way ahead of me and stopped going.
How long did you go to a couple of classes?
I probably only went to a couple of classes.
You know, all of these classes that I took for my book, I went to by myself. It's only now that the book has come out that my boyfriend will occasionally go to a dance with me or to a class with me. But I wonder if maybe it's a good thing to go to a dance class and not know people in the room, particularly at first, because we are all so prone to comparing ourselves to other people, and I think that's an impediment. So maybe it's best to go alone.
Although I did decide I would go to take some ballroom dancing lessons in my old age at this center here in town.
And how are you?
Well, that was awful, because then I had this man that I would not have looked at twice in my youth, knee-high to a grasshopper, kind of pushing me around and complaining that I was treading on his toes, and I just left mortified. So.
Yeah, it's really hard. The classes can be brutal if you're thin-skinned. And in a weird, I mean, not to sound like a total masochist, but I do think that part of why I stuck with this contact improvisation that I do is because I think it's kind of good for me in a weird way to be rejected so many times. A lot of people at this Saturday dance that I go to, particularly in my first year, they would kind of move away from me when I wanted to dance with them, or they would obligingly dance very slack-bodied with me. And yeah, it really bothered me at first, and it hurt my feelings. And then gradually, that happens to you enough times that you just, either you quit or you figure out a way to deal with that. And I chose the latter.
No, that's great. Well, you forged ahead through the pain, which was pretty incredible. And I understand that, because I have lower back things and my back has gone out in my life, and I know what that feels like. I love your using the salad tongs to pull your boxes up because you couldn't bend over.
Oh, my God. Thank you for that validation. Right, that was after I pulled my back out. I believe the second time I was so racked with pain that I could not reach my boxer shorts and get them up onto my hips from the floor. And so, yeah, I used salad tongs. And, you know, at the time, that was not funny to me at all. It was purely a practical thing. And then, you know, there's an old definition of comedy.
Tragedy plus time?
Exactly. Or that it's emotional pain remembered in tranquility.
I love that.
Yeah, it was a bit of a devil, the lower back problems. But the two great things were that Luigi technique that we talked about. That helped to make me more limber. But then I do an hour of Pilates now every week, and that's a time-honored thing that dancers do. It's so great for strengthening the core, and I have not had any back problems for 2 years now.
Is that mat Pilates, Henry, or is that machine Pilates that you do?
I'm doing the machine Pilates, which is expensive, but maybe ultimately I'll figure a way to only do that every other week, maybe, and then maybe do the mat Pilates, maybe mix it up.
I did the machine Pilates, and it was amazing. I loved the fact that I could actually do some exercise lying down and let the machine do it for me, which is sort of what it felt like.
And you don't sweat.
No, the only trouble is I'm a terrible klutz, so it slightly terrifies me that I would somehow get my limbs entangled. But
were you doing it with an instructor?
Yes, I was, but I'm capable of being a klutz no matter how many people are around me, you know.
For you.
Now, what kind of dance was it, or was it any dance that you said could stave off Alzheimer's? They've discovered to like 71, a huge percentage, more than any intellectual activity.
Yeah, right. That was a study done in 2013 where three different groups of seniors each did one activity, crossword puzzles, riding a bicycle, or dancing. And the dancing they were doing was square dancing with a little bit of choreography. And it turned out that of those three activities, dancing had a much higher rate of being able to ward off Alzheimer's. You know, they don't know for sure why that is, but the thought is that because it is both a full body activity and because it requires you to make lots of little fast decisions while you're doing it, that is great for the brain. Now, for me, I mean, I'm 56, so I'm not quite yet at the point where I'm thinking about dementia, but I do notice that dancing every week has really developed my motor skills, that for the first time in my life, I'm not uncomfortable to lean backwards, or I'm not uncomfortable about things happening behind me. That somehow dancing, it's almost like it helps you develop a pair of eyes at the back of your head. It's this weird thing of just being able to handle the physics of space better. So I have to assume that that's related to these neurological studies.
Dance, then, good for the body and the brain and the spirits. Henry Alford discovered its benefits in middle age. Well, let's say rediscovered, because in our youth we just all gravitate towards dance. Henry Alford was my guest on tonight's KX935's The Sharing Hour. He is a celebrated author and journalist, writes for The New Yorker, The New York Times, Vanity Fair, and other publications, has just published his latest book called And Then We Danced, A Voyage into the Groove. It represents his own voyage over the past 7 years into every form of dance he could think of. And I'm so pleased he granted this interview. If you want to hear him talk again, you can revisit this show via iTunes or it podcasts on kx935.com/shows/the-sharing-hour. That's sharing without the G, hour with the H. I'm Sharon James, saying go dance your cares away and come back and listen to more interviews, conversations and more on a wide variety of topics every Sunday night at 6. Here's wishing you a great week ahead.